you. Well, it's exciting to be here, and I see old friends. And there was a time I came here quite a bit when my kids were little. I come from a Jewish background. I married Catholic, and I thought at one point, wouldn't it be fun if we could all do something, you know, as a family? And so we would come up here, and my husband would go, like, Sarah, I was an altar boy. I don't like religion. I'm not into this. And I was a little bit crushed. But my kids went into the kids' programs, and especially my daughter had an awesome time and is still friends with
Yuppie.
Yeah. And so those programs were awesome, and the whole coming of age was awesome. And it was also important to me both to connect with this kind of spiritual community. And also, for quite a while, I was involved with the cups, with the pagan portion of the church, and have done many rituals here in this room. And so that was lovely and supported me through many, many things. So now my main spiritual practice is Tibetan Buddhism. And I always feel it's interesting. I am a registered nurse, and I teach nursing at community college and College of Marin. And so it's always interesting reconciling the whole spiritual path, the religious path, the traditional medical path, and the grand mystery of life. And, you know, so I always kind of channel that. And in my life, I have this interesting thing of sometimes going to things where I'm the most conservative person in the room. Oh, her, she has all those beliefs. And other times going where I'm the most liberal person. And so it's kind of, but I've come to go, okay, so that's who I am, and those are the energies that I balance. So I think what really interests me about religion is this whole idea of energy and moving energy and energetics. As a small child, I think the first time I really had need for a higher power, for a God, for a divine energy, was working with my father. My father had illness. He was had what we would call back then a cardiac cripple, which meant he had a lot of heart attacks. And back in those days, we didn't have the medicines that we did. And so I think as a young child, I wanted to save his life. And I didn't know how, right? So you call on something bigger than yourself, right? And you hope that there's going to be an answer. And my father died young when he was 54. So I didn't really succeed. And this was, you know, very troubling for a child not to succeed in that kind of mission. But also in somehow of doing that exploration, it certainly launched me into a healthcare field. And also always dealing with this, you know, oh, is there some force in the universe that I can open myself to that will help me in this moment, right? This something greater than myself. And so I want to stop there, holding that thought, and I want to do just a little meditation. I know you guys are UUs, and you may, anybody meditate here? Okay. Oh my goodness. Great. This is a basic meditation from mindful stress reduction. But it's really the essence of a lot of my spiritual practice, which is being here in the present notice moment, being here in the present moment. Notice what's going on in your internal world, and then being able to shift into different things, noticing my thoughts, noticing my feelings, noticing my body. And I'm going to kind of come back to those things. But before then, I was telling you a little bit about my childhood and starting to try to work with energies and to call on the divine to help me really save my sick and dying father's life, right? And so that was a huge piece of my my upbringing in turning to the spiritual. Just to give you a little background, I think my parents, they're children of Jewish immigrants. Both my mother and father grew up in quite a lot of poverty. Father went to college on the GI Bill and got a PhD and went on to die at 54. My mother, I would say, was distant and very emotionally challenged. She had cancer, breast cancer growing up. So they had a difficult life. I think they would be what we would be call not emotionally, what's the buzzword there?
Available?
Yes, they were not emotionally available. They were not supportive. They didn't have emotional intelligence, right? The whole Diana Goldman, right? Emotional intelligence. And so as a child, I was pretty much roaming the streets of New York City, you know. And now I think, you know, by the time I was 13, I was out on the subway, which was very challenging because there were a lot of unsavory characters in New York. And so there's a sense for me, like, that I survived my childhood was pretty, pretty amazing. But all of this, you know, I needed to call on something higher than myself. And I think one of the main things my parents taught me was survivalism. My parents were survivors. I think they were very tough people. And so they did impart this. So now we're in the early 70s, right? And so I'm looking for my higher power. And we have the whole women's movement. And we have the civil rights movement and free speech movement. And I just knew at a very early age that the divine for me had to be feminine. And that to deal with the things that I needed to deal with, I needed to be empowered. And I think that was a real motivator for me. And so when I started to look for images of empowerment, they needed to be female. It was just something that was like sort of not negotiable, but just this fiber in my body. And so my first, when I grew up in New York City, I lived in this Irish Catholic, Irish Italian, and then there was a smattering of Jewish people. And remember, my parents were super secular. So the first prayer I learned was Hail Mary. You know, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Right? And when you got into, like, these fixes, like, you'd start to say this and see kind of what happened. And so that was, you know, feminine. And I, you know, there was also all these images of Jesus and the cross. And I'm just starting to get it. I never got it. I never resonated. So, again, moving forward in this feminist era, Jen, any of you remember Judy Chicago and the Birth Project? Oh, yeah, yeah. Yay! So for those of you who don't know Judy Chicago's work, she was a artist, or she, I don't know, she's probably still alive. And she drew these pictures of paintings of women giving birth and of pregnant women. And her big picture was the crowning. And the crowning is that moment where the baby's about to come out. And if you think of this whole force of nature, if you could think of birth as a whole force of nature, she, to me, captured this sense of creativity, of empowerment, of this place of transformation. And so these paintings were very, very important. And actually in my workspace, I have a huge picture of the crowning, which I never get tired of looking at. So I came to find who was most into these images of the divine and feminine empowerment. And so I made my way into people who were into paganism. And we talked a lot about these different, the Greek goddesses and Demeter and Persephone, and we created rituals. And I think we didn't really know what we were doing, at least I didn't back there in my 20s and 30s. And so what I mean by creating rituals is what we would do is we would read some books by Starhawk and Z. Budapest, and we would do things like call in the directions, and the directions were the forces of nature, right? And so we would call in the east, which was air, and the qualities of air, of birds, of our voices, of laughter, and of thoughts. And we would call from the east, you know, we would go to the south, yes? To the south, which was fire and passion. And we would call in those kinds of energies. And then from the south, we would go into the west, and we would call in the water and dreams and the unconscious, right, and all that. And then from there, we would go into the north, to the earth, to the sense of, you know, accomplishing and doing things, you know, things that were tangential. And then we would call in the gods. So I'll read you a poem, which was very important to me at that time. And this is from Starhawk, and this is called The Charge of the Goddess. So think of me 30 years earlier. Okay, I'm going to be 60 this year, so just put that out. Oh, yes, it's happening. Oh, my God. But now I'm 30, okay? So here's my 30 journey. Okay, and this is lovely. Okay. I, who am the beauty of the green earth and the white moon among the stars and the mysteries of the waters, I call upon your soul to arise and come unto me. For I am the soul of nature that gives life to the universe. From me all things proceed, and unto me they must return. Let my worship be in the heart that rejoices, for behold, all acts of love and pleasure are my rituals. Let there be beauty and strength, power and compassion, honor and humility, mirth and reverence within you. And you who seek to know me, know that your seeking and yearning will avail you not unless you know the mystery. For if that which you seek you find not within yourself, you will never find it without. For behold, I have been with you from the beginning, and I am that which is attained at the end of desire. And so that was a poem that we loved and we started. And then we would create these rituals. And so the rituals were about different things. A lot of it was about the seasons and the forces of nature and how we fit into that. And the sense of aligning ourselves with the earth was very important. And it really all came to this idea, I think, of transformation, transcending oneself, and the sense of feeling empowered. And going back to being a woman, it's very hard to feel empowered a lot. And we're seeing this again with, you know, the things that are going on in politics right now. Let's control women's bodies. We can't make our own decisions. How many women can we elect? Can we elect a woman president? I know you're all Bernie Sanders fans, but I'll just, you know, go. Oh, no. Okay. Okay. Just don't split the vote. But it was this idea of trying to create transformation. Then I went on and I met some women who came from a goddess background like I did. But they also were starting to work with Buddhism, and particularly Tibetan Buddhism. And it started for me with this whole dance of the 21 Taras. So Tara is a Tibetan goddess. I'll say goddess in quotes. And there's 21 aspects of her. And this woman created this just beautiful dance ritual where there's kind of a chorus, and then people come out and dance these different aspects of the goddess. And for me, there's this all sense of being embodied, right? And so embodied is, yes, you know, took LSD back in the 70s, right? And it's all up here. And so this idea of, you know, can you come down, can you bring it in, and can you integrate it, right? And so it's not what you saw, but it's how much you can integrate it, bring it back, and make it useful. And so that was really the whole thing. And so for me, useful is the whole being in the body, right? Can you body? And so this dancing of the goddesses was like, oh. And so having those moments, perhaps, where you feel completely connected, like you're here, connected to all of you, connected to all of these forces in the universe, and you're still conscious and moving and doing your thing, right? And so that was what that dance was for me. And so that was how I got interested in this thing called Buddhism, which I really, you know, didn't know too much about, except I have always loved those tankas and those pictures, you know, like in the Asian Art Museum. And I would go and like hang out and go, wow, they've got some great pictures here. So that was very pivotal, this piece. And then moving forward another decade, my mother-in-law, who I was very attached to, had died. And she was an amazing woman. She was an activist, a peace activist, and she was a good Catholic who would go out and celebrate Mass, right? And this is how you know that feminism, we have a long way to go, because the Pope is bringing it up, right? Maybe women should become deacons and maybe they could celebrate Mass. And it's like, you just have to go, WTF, right? For those over 50, that's like, what the fuck? Yeah. Right? Like, duh. But, you know, we're still there. And it's just a matter of, right, how, you know, every time we think that perhaps women have equality, we just can remember some of these things. And we go, no, like, you know, we have a long way to go. Okay, so did these dances. My mother-in-law died, and my mother was very sick. And so I very serendipitously decided I was going to go on a retreat to this place called Tara Mandala. And it was just a series of sort of fortuitous circumstances, and I had really no idea what I was getting into, but there I was in a car, I was driving to Colorado, and this place is up at like 7,000 feet, and it's this very amazing Tibetan temple retreat center that's absolutely gorgeous. And so I went there, and I was camping out on their land, and they've got bears and everything else. And I realized this is the first time in my life I've been camping by myself. And it's just like, go pick a spot and just camp. And, you know, the nature is out there. And I was out there, and I was having altitude sickness, and I'm trying to put up this tent, which is just like, you know, flapping and like pushing me over, and I'm lying on my back, and like I give up, and all of this kind of stuff. And being there was the most transformative piece of my life, and I'm still very involved with this sangha, this Tibetan sangha, and I want to try to explain a little bit. So I think as someone who was doing energy work, who was doing ritual, my first thought about being there was, oh, these people really understand all these things that I was trying to do when I was creating ritual, but they understand it so much deeper and bigger, and they have methods to deal with all these energies. And I felt like this, like, real kind of babe in the woods being there. And it was like I had 1,000 questions I didn't even know I had answered pretty instantaneously. So some of the highlights I want to share, I think my favorite thing going there is we would do this meditation and you would wake up about, I don't know, 5 or 6 in the morning, and then you would hike up to what they called Prayer Flag Ridge, which was this ridge, and then you would sit out and you do this open eye meditation. And it's this open spaciousness. And so many times we meditate and it's, our eyes are closed and it's very internal. The thing that was different about this is this sense of openness. And so here, in that sense of being connected to everything, is something that they were actually very actively seeking. And you got like step-by-step instructions. And that was huge. And so this is a kind of a pivotal idea that was important to me. So the idea of resting in awareness, right? And so for many of us, we think about, where's our mind, you know, when it's on autopilot? And at least for me, this is like a big piece of meditation. You know, it's like,
it's 10 a.m. Do you know where your mind is?
Right? doing all these things, and most of the time we're just, you know, pretty oblivious. And yet, you know, when we sit down and we meditate, we start to have more of a sense of our internal experience, right? And so this idea of resting in this vastness is this idea of, if we spend a lot of time really identifying with our thoughts. You know, I think this, therefore I am this. I feel this, therefore I am this. And we get a lot of identity from those types of patterns. When you rest in the idea of awareness itself, that really opens you into a different place. And so how does this help you? And I'll give you an example. I'm cold. Where's my jacket? I'm hungry. Where's my food? Right? And so we find ourselves kind of ping-ponging around. You know, I don't like this. I don't like that. You know, I need this. I need that. When you rest in this field of awareness, it's more like, oh, okay, I'm hungry. It'll pass. Or just noticing that I'm cold. It's okay. And so you don't get into this whole reactive place of kind of being a ping-pong person, you know, ping-ponging from one thought to another. And so this resting in awareness. The other thing that really happens in this big open spaciousness types of meditation is they talk a lot about the idea of this ground of being, right? And so there's lots of words for it in different religious processes. But I think of it as, and why don't we just take a moment? It'll help me. So if you want, you can close your eyes. Just take a moment and might notice what's going on, your thoughts, your emotions, bodily sensations. And instead of focusing on that, if you just take a moment, perhaps, and look at awareness. Just this facility, faculty of awareness. And then I'll have you slowly open your eyes. So a lot of people, not only Tibetan Buddhism, but Jon Kabat-Zinn does a lot of talk about resting in awareness. And so in this, my spiritual practice, this becomes kind of a fundamental shift, resting in awareness as opposed to your thoughts and feeling. So that was one of the huge things that happened, this open spaciousness of mind. And I was going into this ground of being. And so when you rest in awareness and you start to go, where does that come from? And you start to realize that you have a small mind that has small conceptions. And when you sort of rest in awareness or this open spaciousness, and the more rest into this spaciousness, then the more that you allow to come in. And it's a sense of being more free and also a sense of the world being, I use the word, bigger. You become very aware of, I've created this little world and this is my little prison, you know, and I think it's very good. But you see the spaciousness. Oh, that's outside the wall of me, right? And you get to start to, those boundaries start to crumble a bit, which is fun and interesting. I think the other thing that happened for me there, which was pretty moving, is I told you that I'm a nurse, and as nurse, I'm a very empathetic person. And being someone who works a lot with energy, suffering is something I've spent my life with. I worked for over 10 years in an ER in Oakland, so I've seen a lot of suffering. And there's a sense of taking it in, right? And there's a sense, and maybe of you, this might sound familiar, that I'm going to help you by I'm going to be holding your suffering, right? Oh, that's so sad, and I'm going to be sad with you and feel all distressed because I think I'm sharing your burden. And I was talking to someone who was also a healthcare practitioner, and she said, you know, let me show you something. And I said, okay. And so she taught me this Tibetan practice called Tonglin. And some of you know this. This is Pema Chodron's big work, right? And so this was the idea of when you take someone's suffering in, then you send out love and compassion. And so this coming, you know, it's not like you're turning away from their suffering, but the idea that you don't need to suffer in that same way and go home and go, oh, I'm so miserable. You know, the world is so terrible. There's so much sadness. There's so much pain. But again, you know, taking that in, sending out love and compassion. And this was pretty pivotal for me to be able to stay in the helping professions, especially at this time in my life where I was dealing with, you know, the death of my mother-in-law and my mother's illness, and she actually died the next year. So another important thing. So I was at this Tara Mandala retreat, and I was learning to balance energies, and I was learning to work with all kinds of things that I didn't really know about. And then the Lama said, well, I'm going to be doing this refuge ceremony, and would people want to take refuge? And this is the first time I heard about this. And so we think of things that we take refuge in, like drugs, alcohol, food, sex, for starters, right?
Cell phones.
Cell phones, yes, thank you, cell phones, absolutely. And so for me, and you know, maybe this was different for you, but for me, this was the first time this very articulated sense of taking refuge in religion, in Buddhism. And so she's describing what this whole practice was, and she says, and then you enter the mind stream. And I was like, oh, entering the mind stream. And exactly. And I knew, I didn't know what it meant, but I knew I wanted it. So me, I knew I wanted it. So me and my friend, who I'm still friends with from this day, who I just met at the retreat, who was retired, and she's a psychotherapist. We were like two little schoolgirls. Do you think you're going to take refuge? I don't know. I will if you will. What will happen to us? I don't know. And I mean, this is the thing. And there was this sense of, like, really excitement. But so then you got, you know, dressed up and you bought flowers. And then we went and we took refuge and entered the mind stream. So what does that mean? I have no idea.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. It's a lot. So, what do I want to tell you? What else? So, those were very pivotal things for me. I wanted to go back to this idea of resting in awareness, and I'd like to read you one of my favorite little quotes from Jon Kabat-Zinn. You guys know who Jon Kabat-Zinn is? He's one of my heroes. One of my big heroes. And this goes back to the sense of awareness. And this is his book, Mindfulness for Beginners. And it's not taking our thoughts personally. And he writes, "It is a big step toward reclaiming our lives when we realize that no matter what their content, good, bad, or ugly, we do not have to take our thoughts personally. We do not even have to believe them. We do not even have to think of them as ours. We can recognize them simply as thoughts, as events in the field of awareness, events that arise and pass away very rapidly, that sometimes carry insights, sometimes enormous emotional charge that can have a huge effect for better or for worse in our lives, depending on how we are in relationship to them. When we don't automatically take them personally or believe the stories about reality that we build from them, when we can simply hold them in awareness with a sense of curiosity and wonder at their amazing power, given their insubstantiality, their limitations, and inaccuracies, then we have a chance, right in that moment, in any moment really, to not get caught in their habitual patterning, to see thoughts for what they are, impersonal events, and instead to be the knowing that awareness already is. The knowing that awareness already is. Then in that moment at least, we are already free, ready to act with greater clarity and kindness within the constantly changing field of events that is nothing other than life unfolding. Not always as we think it should, but definitely as it is." So one of the things I like to say, and I talk to my nursing students about this a lot, is, you know, I'm not having the day that I planned. I'm having the day that I'm having, right? And so for me, who has spent a lot of my life in chaotic situations, right, in the sense, you know, you work in an ER, you can't control very much, right? You can go. And then, you know, all these things start happening. And so this idea of, you know, surfing, right? Okay, so there's going to be lots of waves, and I'm just going to surf on through. And so the more, you know, fluid you are, and the more you can kind of let go of those boundaries, the more you're able to not react, but to respond to these events that are going on. So for me, this whole kind of journey into Buddhism has been something that's given me tools that I can better manage my life. And so the sense of the tools of awareness, the sense of the tools of responding instead of reacting. I think the tools of kindness and compassion. Right, and I think that's essential. And you know, the most important thing the Dalai Lama has ever said is, "My religion is kindness." And you know, if we can just go in that peace, I think it's really important. And so, this whole thing of kindness and compassion and going back to the ground of being. Right. So, what's the first thing that happens? Birth.
2 minutes.
2 minutes. Okay. Birth. Right? Big cosmic event. What's the first response of the parents? Love, kindness, and compassion. Yes, and that's right, exactly. And so if we keep going back to that beginning, and that is the divine feminine, right? Right there. And it comes back. It's the mother, there's the baby, love, kindness, compassion. And then as adults, we never let go of that as being the most important thing. And as Jewish people say, everything else is commentary. So so there it is. And so, and that's the flame of the essential of what does the divine feminine mean, right? What does the divine feminine need? And so Lama Sultram says, treat everyone. Everyone has been your parent. Everyone has been your mother in one of your lifetimes. And so looking at everyone, we're all related. You know, we were all in these relationships with each other. And so for 2 minutes, that summing up, you know, is there a God? Who cares? You know, I think that there are forces of energy, and that we can move with forces of energy, and whether the force of energy is the Divine Mother. This is my favorite divine energy mind state. This is Machik Labdrin, and you can see she's a wild, naked, dancing Dakini, and she's got her friends, the Four Directions. And so, you know, and so it's an energetic, it's a very lively, dancing, you know, naked awareness is what the nakedness stands for, right? And so, again, going back to that ground of being, you know, that resting in awareness, that open spaciousness of mind. And so then I hang out and I take my students to the hospital and we meditate a little bit before we start doing what we're doing, and it's all good. I like to tell you, Lama Sultram is coming to the Bay Area. She's my Lama who I took refuge with. She, for those of you who like Spirit Rock, she'll be at Spirit Rock on May 28th. Doing Feeding Your Demons, which is a really interesting spiritual practice. You don't have to believe in any gods or goddesses or anything to do it. And then the one I think I don't want to miss is Wisdom Rising, Reawakening the Sacred Feminine with Spring Washam. And Spring Washam is pretty awesome. She teaches a lot at the East Bay Meditation Center. And so that'll be cool. So I will open it up for questions. Yes?
The Dalai Lama believes in reincarnation.
And it seems to me, the Dalai Lama believes in reincarnation, but it seems to me that if we are reincarnated, there's no reason to regret or fear death. Wouldn't you say that's true?
I would say there's no reason to regret or fear death. I would say reincarnation may or may not happen, and it's not a primary interest of mine. And I have no expertise on it.
Any other questions?
I've always been struck by the nature of language in these areas and the importance of what metaphors we decide to use for ourselves.
Yes.
And you started out by saying that as a child you were looking for a higher power. And at the end of the day, I think what is more useful and what became more useful for you was to look to see whether there are broader powers, more things that are powerful that can lead to personal empowerment that are not up there in the sense of being higher, because that's sort of the anthropological way of thinking of God, but there are things that are all around us that are more powerful. And it's other people, it's nature, it's animals, it's the air we breathe, and it's all around and broader rather than higher.
Yes, I completely agree with you. And I think what I meant perhaps by higher power was, again, if you look at yourself as being 13 and, you know, trying to save someone's life with no medical training, not really understanding what the heck was going on. My parents were pretty isolated. I didn't have a lot of adults. I didn't have, like, my whole family was in Cleveland, not New York. So I didn't, you know, it's like I didn't really have someone to go help me figure this out. So I think what I was reaching for was something outside myself to solve. But also, I think, again, going back to energetics, and I think it's always interesting, this sense of resonating with something, right? And so, in this case, it was healing. And so if I asked you all for a moment to just think about healing, and just get that sense, and we can take a moment of what is that energetic of healing? And you could think of something as easy as a Band-Aid on your finger, or what you do when you have a cold. And so there's this idea of healing as an energetic, and I think this is what the Buddhists are brilliant about. And they take this energetic, let's call healing, and then they create something called Medicine Buddha. And then they create certain prayers and rituals. And so there's this riding on this wave. And so that's a lot of the way that I think of it now. Oh, healing wave, please. Which is not to say I'm going to cure someone's cancer, but it is to say that there's an energetic. I know Jon Kabat-Zinn talks brilliantly about the placebo effect, right? So I give you a medicine, and I say I'm giving you some morphine as a nurse, and I say this is going to make you feel so much better, right? But I gave you just normal saline. But you felt so much better. Placebo effect, right? I go, oh, it's placebo. But Jon Kabat-Zinn said, this placebo effect, this is amazing, right? This is our ability to heal, to believe that a drug can make us better. He said, we shouldn't be ignoring this. We should be studying this, right? And so that's the beginning of opening it up. So, yes, so higher power now. There are many powers. They're all around us. They're in us. They're outside. Great.
Any other questions?
Yes. There's here and here.
You talk about resting in awareness. To you, is awareness a concept, or is it a... Because it sounds like a contradiction. When you're at rest, you are aware. But if you're resting in awareness, that means there's something other than just rest. You know what I'm trying to say? What is awareness to you?
Great question. I'll say that I think of it as a place that I get to. And I think of it as a dropping down. And I think of, I've got my conceptual mind, and it's going blah, 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 and I've got my feelings. And then I come to this other place, and I could only say that it's down, and it's very open and spacious. Perhaps in the sky, a cloudless sky.
Is it a thought?
It's not, I would say it's not a thought so much as a... It's not a thought so much as a place that you get to. So I would say that it's a concept, that it's a feeling, and it's arriving.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the big question.
I just wanted to thank you. Excuse me. For creating a space that you are talking about. Do you know what I mean? This place was with you. So thank you.
You're welcome, and thank you for noticing. And I tried to make it experiential, and that's what I mean by, you know, energy work and energetics, and that's, to me, is the essence of ritual. Great. Thank you.
I have read some interesting studies where they've done some brain scans of meditators. And,
yes.
one of the things that shows up is that when you get to that space, it's because a part of your brain gets quiet, it shuts down. And it seems to be basically a chemical thing that goes on in your head. And it would be interesting to think about it that way and then try to actually train that part of your brain. But as you get to that space of awareness, to pay attention to what the brain feels like inside, so that you can feel which part is quiet.
Yeah, that's a great comment. Dan Siegel, who's out of UCLA, he says the mind is what the brain does. And so really, we are biological beings, and the brain is a bunch of chemicals and electric, and they have done these studies, and they're called fMRIs, which is, you know, real time. They put people in MRIs, and they've looked at monks, and they said, okay, do compassion and do open spaciousness, and they start to track it. And then also there's the whole concept of neuroplasticity, which is basically, if you think of neurons as tracks, and that if you meditate, you start to develop these different tracks, and that's why meditators are more compassionate, we're more mindful, we're more aware, because we're developing rather than the, oh, where's my keys, or, oh, I'm going to give this talk, oh, I'm going to fail, I'm going to, you know, I'm never going to be good at anything, you know, right? We start to go down the rabbit hole or in our tapes, but we learn how to turn on something else, you know, this kindness, this awareness. So I'm just going to come here. I'm going to drop into awareness, drop you into awareness, and we're going to move forward.
It's a muscle of the brain.
It's a muscle, exactly. That's exactly right. And that's why 20 minutes a day, they say 20 minutes a day of meditation is enough to change your brain. And there's some good books, you know, what is it? I forget the... anyway, there's a lot of them, yeah, on those, that concept. Yeah?
Sorry, I missed some of this, but this morning I just have to say I was listening early to the radio about prisoners being literally forced to locked in this meditation class, and that this guy on Skid Row for murder said he'd rather go back to solitary than have to sit there and really face his feelings and his insight, that it was the hardest thing. He just wanted to flee. But he learned so much. And, you know.
Yeah, no, it's...
It really killed him just to realize what was going on.
Yeah, Annie Lamont has a great quote, and she says, there are places in my mind that are like a bad neighborhood, and I don't want to go in alone after dark. And that's how many of us, our mind is, and we're so distressed by what's going on in our minds. And so you're absolutely right that this idea of meditation, and you sit there and you go, I mean, for me, shame is a big thing. Oh, I'm so ashamed. And then every time you start to go near that, you just go, oh, and you just like. And so with meditation, well, okay, I'm just going to look at it just a little bit, right? And then you start to show up for your own life, right? And that's the whole piece. And that's what he's talking about. And, you know, I've been on week-long meditation, silent meditation retreats, you know, at Spirit Rock. And about the third day, all this stuff you didn't even know was there starts coming up. And you're like, oh, my goodness. Right? And so, yes. So, and that's all you have to do is, like, it's sort of like, I don't know, it's not like prison. But anyway, it's you're there. You're there, right? And that's what you do. You, like, you sit there in this sense of incredible empowerment that comes through, you know. I know we all have, you know, our own stories that freak us out. But that being present in a supportive space while your story is unfolding and you were there, and then you get to, okay, so I'm the adult, you know, I'm in my awareness, you know, I'm not that child when that horrible thing happened, right? And then that's healing, and that's, you know, where you can start to move forward. And that's, I think they call it the fruits of the practice, right? And then now I'm not afraid of that place in my mind anymore, or that I'm going to go, or that, you know, somebody's going to trigger it. And believe me, if you work in a hospital, people are going to trigger you, like, all the time, because they're all going through crises, right? And so if you're going around, like, you'll just...
Yeah, we've all seen Nurse Jackie.
Yeah. I haven't. I refuse. It's not entertaining for me.
Okay, that's all the time that we have. So thank you so much, Sarah. We really appreciate your being here today.
Thank you. If any